This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. You'll see some work underway on a section of the 2700 block of West 35th Avenue in Gary that will soon, at least by the end of the year, the hopes are, to house a 165,000-square-foot facility that will better process Northwest Indiana's solid waste. With us to talk more about the project is the CEO of Maya Energy LLC, Jim Ventura. And Jim, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, tell us a little bit first about what Maya Energy LLC is all about and the process that you all went through to come up with the idea of creating a way to better process solid waste that Northwest Indiana residents and businesses generate.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chris. Real quickly, Maya Energy is a LLC that we put together in 2015 for the mission of being able to responsibly be able to recycle waste in a manner that was effective and efficient and avoid the waste going to our landfill, which affects the greenhouse gases. With that said, we formed a company. We moved through a process in Gary where we secured 35 acres off Grant Street and 35th Avenue in Gary, Indiana. Mm-hmm. The process took a long time, several years, because we have to go through local zoning notices and so forth, council meetings, public hearings. So it was a very, very complicated, very detailed process that we went through, and we completed it, and I'm glad that we're here today.
I understand that it's the same general area, at least not far away, as to where Lake County Solid Waste Management District's composting site's located out there. They're along 35th and Grant. So it's kind of become an environmentally a processing area, hasn't it?
Exactly, and we look forward to working with the Lake County Solid Waste because I know they do the leaf collection, and we're going to be having, you know, what we call wood waste branches and so forth. So we looking forward to working with them also.
Now, I understand that Maya Energy LLC is going to use some of the latest state-of-the-art technology to be able to better process this waste that you're bringing in. First off, will you talk a little bit about what the processes will be, as well as how the collection process is going to be able to get the communities to bring this material in?
Sure. First of all, the technology has really come a long way in the last 7 years, recycling process. So we are using a company out of San Francisco, California, called the CP Group. They've been around for a long time. They have actually put in their system in over 400 material recovery facilities worldwide. So we visited the plant. We liked the equipment. We liked the company. So we partnered with them to bring in the technology to our facility. The technology they have, we'll use the latest recycling technology to be able to take out the paper, plastic, and cardboard. Municipal solid waste, we will use things like optical sorters that shoots a beam and a light at different types of plastic bottles, and it separates them into 2D, 3D, and so forth. Mm-hmm. We also are looking right now, we're looking very closely into using the latest, which is robotics. They'll be able to take a wood to be able to separate it. And these robotic arms, they pick the waste off a conveyor. They can do probably 4,000 picks a minute. Unbelievable. You know, six times more than a human can do it. So we're looking at that also. And we're also looking at safeguards with the COVID right now, how to be able to have a facility that safeguards the workers, kind of make sure that they don't handle the waste too much, and again, protects them and protects their health.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of staff members, how many people do you hope eventually the facility will be able to have out there as employees to help the city of Gary in particular?
Now, Chris, we're looking at, to start off, we're looking at probably about 55 to 65 full-time employees. We're looking at another 40 ancillary jobs, those are like trucking and so forth. And then total, I would say over the next couple of years, looking at about 125 full-time employees.
Now, I know that some of the initial information that's come out here when Maya Energy LLC was formed talks about the material that you want to collect and you want to be able to process. And that includes both municipal solid waste, which people basically consider trash or garbage, I guess is the old-fashioned term for it, but also construction and demolition debris. For people that are not familiar with what that is, tell us about that and how you're hoping that the facility that you're building out there in Gary is going to be able to handle that and get that off to different uses.
Yes. So, Chris, what we're going to do is we're going to have several lines. We're going to have two dedicated lines strictly for municipal solid waste in the facility, and we're going to have one line dedicated to the separation of the C&D waste, which is construction and demolition debris, which comes from abandoned houses, new housing, construction, any waste that comes out of there. We will take it and we will separate wood, we will separate drywall and so forth, and concrete, and we will recycle it back into, you know, into the industry.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got very experienced people to do this. Superintendent has had over 30 years in the waste business. He's ran huge facilities, so we've got a good team to do it, and we've got a lot of interested cities and independent haulers interested in bringing us the waste.
Has the opportunity to be able to locate the facility in Gary been to your all advantage, especially since we know that the city administration wants to deal with the abandoned houses, and there are unfortunately so many of them in the city of Gary, and then there's been some work, I know, to be able to process some of the waste from these abandoned houses, but there's probably a lot more to come in.
Absolutely. I had a conference call with the mayor a couple of weeks ago and his economic development director. They went real well, and we did discuss the C&D problem, the abandoned houses in Gary. And we're looking to sit with the city of Gary in the next couple of weeks to try to work out a solution. And Maya is, we told them, Mayor, we're here to help work with the city to make it possible to be able to knock these houses, recycle them, and so forth, and work closely with the city of Gary. It was a very positive conversation.
I know that there are other organizations and businesses in Gary that are now dealing with handling solid waste. Carmuse Lime up there off Lake Michigan is also using their own processes that they've set up to be able to bring solid waste in, municipal solid waste in particular, and turn that into processes. What are you hoping that My Energy LLC can do that might be a little different?
Well, first of all, I know Carmuse. I've been to their facility there. What they basically do, they take a lot of the hazardous oils, the sludges, okay, where we deal with strictly municipal solid waste, mm-hmm. construction, demolition, debris. We're different than what they do, and they process it right there in Carmuse, because Carmuse, they own 50% of Vexor, who does all the processing for them. So we're different. We have a different market. And right now, like I said, Chris, we've got such an overwhelming support from haulers. We're strategically located in the right position. Over 10,000 to 12,000 tons of municipal solid waste go right through the area into the landfill in Union County.
What kind of support? You mentioned about City Hall and what the city administration wants to do to be able to see you folks get started here. What other support have you gotten, perhaps from the area construction and the unions that are going to help out in getting the facility built?
Oh, it's been very positive. I mean the people in the waste industry, we've met with them, and you know, we were going to do a groundbreaking back in December, but the COVID issue stopped us. And we sent out the flyers. We had overwhelming response. People were going to come to the dinner, but unfortunately, like I said, we had to cancel it because of COVID. But we're moving forward. We've got a complete support of waste. We've got letters of intent already. We've got contracts already signed, so we've got overwhelming support.
What kind of opportunities have you had since the first word of putting the process in place to be able to get the facility built and all? What kind of support have you gotten in talking with neighbors, so to speak, there along 35th Avenue and others that live in that side of Gary as to what you're planning to do and how to deal with their concerns?
Well, you know, when we went through the process, that was all addressed through the state permitting, and we had all the public hearings. You know, they were all over the newspaper. Some of the things that were said were not true. Some of the stuff that, you know, that were reported wasn't accurate. But I never took the position of trying to you know, say things or I don't want to be adversarial. My Energy is here to work with the mayor, the city of Gary, Lake County, because this is definitely going to create an impact, a positive impact. The plant is going to be a state-of-the-art, beautiful facility. We have indoor tippers, the only ones in the country, indoor, complete and closed. So we've done everything. We've gone through the process. It's been very detailed. We've had, you know, neighbors give their comments to the state. They reviewed everything we were doing closely. They were really, really honest about, you know, being very, very careful how we build this facility, make sure we take everything into account, and we did that. And again, everything worked out good. We got our permits, and we're happy.
Now, Jim, if you will, bring us up to date with how the project is coming along. What stages are you in right now? And what folks that come by the neighborhood there on West 35th Avenue are likely to see go up here in the months ahead? And when also do you hope to have the facility open for business, so to speak, for processing the solid waste?
Yes. What we're doing right now is, Chris, we're right now working with the City of Gary. They have a engineering company they work with called Robertson Engineering. We're working closely with our engineers with Robertson Engineering. We're doing soil borings on 35th Avenue. We just got it done yesterday. We've done soil borings on the land itself, the 35 acres. We're waiting for the results. Once we get those results, we're going to submit to a site plan review committee through zoning and planning in the fire department, and we're going to go over to the whole construction that we're going to do out there. And we're looking to get our first permit, actually, so we can put in a culvert, and we're going to put in the entrance to the facility that will allow us now to start bringing in trucks, crushed rock, dirt, and start elevating the property. That will happen within the next, I would say, 30 to 60 days. We're going to be staking out the property pretty soon. They will see stakes out there. We're working on the foundation designs, get them approved by the city. And I would say by March, toward the end of March, maybe April, you're going to start seeing the foundation of the building go up. Mm-hmm. And we'll hopefully be open by the end of the year.
Is that a property out there, or land out there, I should say, that wasn't maybe at one time was zoned for agricultural purposes and then got changed over into industrial and commercial purposes? And so it never really was set up to be more than just farmland out there. That's why you have to go through the process of being able to put more roads and the like in to get in off 35th Avenue, that be ready for the truck traffic that'll have to come out there.
Yeah, definitely. So that's why what we did was a traffic study before we started the project. And what we're basically doing with the city, when we get together with them, we're going to talk about 35th. We've got money in the budget. Obviously, we're trying to get some funds from the state, hopefully a matching fund to be able to improve 35th Avenue, obviously, for our facility being open.
Now, you mentioned that you're aiming toward the end of 2021. Are you looking forward to having a facility out there and ready to go to be able to better process what people are throwing away, what businesses are throwing away these days?
Yes, we're looking We're definitely working hard to try to get there by the end of the year to be fully open and operational of 2021.
Jim Ventura is the CEO of Maya Energy LLC. They are in the process of getting ready to build a 165,000 square foot solid waste processing facility on the west edge of Gary at West 35th Avenue near Grant Street, and the plan to be in open for business or later this year is the plan right now. And Mr. Ventura, thank you for being with us today to talk about the project.
Chris, thank you for having me. Anytime, call me.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. NIPSCO is moving forward into its renewable energy initiative called Your Energy, Your Future, bringing lower cost, cleaner, and sustainable energy to NIPSCO customers today and into the future as well. The lead engineer for the utility's renewables team, Andy Campbell, and NIPSCO spokesperson Tara McElmurray were on Regionally Speaking to talk about the initiative and about the first two wind farms that are now set up and actually online.
Our Your Energy, Your Future generation transition plan started back in 2018 when we were going through our integrated resource planning process, which is something we do every couple years. One thing that we did different in 2018 was we conducted a request for proposal process in which we analyzed hundreds of proposals, checking to see what would be, the best source of generating energy for our customers going forward. And we found, which was actually quite a surprise to us with the technology advancements, that renewable resources such as wind, solar, and battery technology were actually most cost-effective for our customers. As a result of that, of moving forward with those technologies, we are going to be retiring both of our remaining coal plants. Our Schaefer Generating Station, which is in Wheatfield, Indiana, will be retired in 2023. And then our Michigan City Generating Station in Michigan City, Indiana, is planned to be retired in 2028. So we will be 100% coal-free by 2028. In its place, we will be replacing that generation with, as I said, a mix of wind, solar, and battery technology, which will be joining our also our Sugar Creek Generating Station, which is our natural gas plant down in Terre Haute, mm-hmm. along with our hydroelectric generation, which is in Monticello, Indiana. And with all of that, we will be saving our customers more than $4 billion over wow. the long term.
Andy, if you will, from the renewable assets team side, what did you all discover in talking with the contractors and getting the first two projects, certainly, that are now online, the Rosewater Wind and the Jordan Creek Wind plants online? What have you learned that is going to be the future of NIPSCO with these projects and many more that are coming up?
Obviously, we are resolute in running our quest for proposals to really find the best projects. NIPSCO is not, quote-unquote, in the development business. So we want to leave the building of these assets to the quote-unquote professionals who do it every day, right? And the two wind farms that came online recently are consistent with kind of our short-term action plan to bring on some wind to gain some additional experience. The first one is in Jordan Creek in Benton Warren County, Indiana, 400 megawatts. And that's a purchase power agreement with our partners at NextEra Energy Resources. And a purchase power agreement is basically an agreement where NextEra will continue to own and operate the facility, and NIPSCO is agreeing to buy the power from there. Rosewater, with a partner, EDP Renewables, is a joint venture asset, which is basically a different term for a NIPSCO project that NIPSCO will own. That project, in addition, will operate, and NIPSCO will have full responsibility for that project and is a part of its overall fleet. So with those projects, they were kind of the first offing of both of those structures for us, pursuant to the integrated resource plan that Tara mentioned. And then obviously we've had a number of announcements related to solar mm-hmm. and other wind farm and battery storage that we expect to come online between now and 2023.
Tell us a little bit about the ones that folks here in Northwest Indiana are likely to see as far as the solar panels are concerned. I know there are some projects that are going to be planned for places like in Jasper County in particular and some other counties in Indiana as well. Tell us about those.
We've announced build transfer agreements, joint venture structures with NextEra Energy Resources. There's going to be two projects in Jasper County, right around 700 megawatts of solar installation and then 75 megawatt battery as well. In addition, in White County, there'll be a 200 megawatt facility that has a 60 megawatt hour battery in addition. So those are all really well located in NIPSCO service territory. And, the technology in general is kind of advanced to the point where we feel it's an adequate replacement for the coal facilities. And, as far as locationally, we don't necessarily, tell these developers where to put these projects. The nature of the agreement is we either buy the power from the facility or we agree to buy the project when it's complete. And the development is really left to the professionals. And with wind and solar, it's important to have a lot of geographic diversity so that if the sun's maybe not shining in one spot, it's perhaps shining in another, or the wind is maybe diminished here and higher there. So having a mix of projects spread throughout our service territory as well as even other parts of the state can provide a value of diversity there to kind of protect that energy flow.
Do you think that's going to be the best advantage that NIPSCO has, is that if you have a day where maybe you have lots of sunshine here in the northwest corner of the state, but not so much in other places, and vice versa, that maybe it's cloudy here in Lake County, say, but it's not cloudy in Henry County over in the eastern side of the state, that you're going to have the advantage of shifting the power around?
So shifting the power around is key, but also what's key is NIPSCO itself is kind of what's part of a broader integrated market that energy market that really covers all of Indiana and, in fact, really the whole central part of the United States. So we have access. We essentially sell the power that we create to that market, and we buy what we need. And that occurs with all other utilities that are a member of this market. So it really provides diversity and location that NIPSCO customers gain advantages of, from everything down to the Louisiana coast all the way up to the Canadian border across the central part of the U.S. So while we have projects that we anticipate will be spread throughout the state of Indiana and even one more so announced in the northern part of Kentucky, we actually take value in our energy needs from the broader integrated market as well.
Well, Tara, it sounds like from NIPSCO's standpoint, it's going to be a very exciting years ahead as the initiative gets going and bring these opportunities in to bring more renewable energy into the picture here in the region.
Absolutely. We're super excited for, you know, all of our what's already been announced and what's to come here in 2021. Definitely excited to be, you know, making the state of Indiana more attractive to employers and residents, and definitely excited to begin saving our customers money.
That's Tara McElmurray along with Andy Campbell from NIPSCO talking about the renewable energy projects that are underway. Today, we continue our reflection series exploring how the lives of Midwesterners have been changed by the coronavirus pandemic. This 28-year-old woman was hit hard by the virus, and she became the first COVID patient to have a double lung transplant. And she talks about her recovery in a story that was produced by SideFX Public Media's Christine Herman.
My name is Myra Ramirez, and I live in Bridgeview, Illinois. I had my transplant on June 5th, and I was inpatient at the hospital for a few weeks after that. Woke up, didn't recognize my body, couldn't move, couldn't really breathe. And after that, you know, I went to Shirley Ryan, the rehabilitation center that I went to for physical therapy and occupational therapy, speech therapy. I did a lot of, you know, day-to-day things like brushing my teeth I wasn't able to do before. Brushing my hair and, you know, just walking, a lot of walking and showering, bathing myself. I thought at the beginning, everything was just so fast. Every single day I was improving. I was being able to do more than I was the day before. You know, that kind of hit a plateau and then started to decline. And that's due to an infection that I contracted. But it got really bad. I had this awful cough, fevers, chills, a lot of fatigue, nausea, vomiting. And turns out that a CT scan showed that I have an infection in my sternum where bacteria is eating away at my bone. The bacteria is really rare and it's really hard to treat. What they did was they went in and scraped off like the infected bone, like scraped off like the infected skin as well. They did that twice before closing it up. And that was at the end of last year in November. So now we're just trying to get better, waiting for my scars to heal, you know, dealing with letting my body heal again. I feel like at the beginning I was so much more hopeful, like I'm gonna get back to myself. You know, this is just a minor inconvenience. I felt like I had some hope that things would get better. And now it just feels like not. In the beginning, I had a lot of anxiety attacks, a lot of panic attacks, but I'm dealing much better with that now. I'm doing much better in my job. I'm a paralegal at an immigration firm. I help people obtain immigration benefits. Not only have I been back, but I'm also taking like leadership roles. I'm holding more responsibilities. I feel useful. I feel like I have a purpose and I feel like I can still help others. The hardest part are the physical impediments. The more I try and the harder I try, the more I realize that I'm never going to be back to myself, but I can just be happy and grateful for, honestly, just being able to use the bathroom by myself and just being able to continue my work, maintain my health insurance. I'm honestly just happy to be alive.
That's Myra Ramirez. She was the first COVID-19 patient in the U.S. to receive a double lung transplant last June. The story was produced by SideFX Public Media's Christine Herman. A big challenge for public health officials has been the skepticism many Black Americans have toward COVID-19 vaccines. One notorious medical study has been cited as the reason. Gene Demby has the report that was aired on Morning Edition, and here is host Scott Detrow to introduce it to you.
A lot of Black Americans are skeptical about taking any of the coronavirus vaccines. It's a sentiment that's been captured by several polls and reflected in interviews for the NPR podcast Code Switch.
I'm hesitant to take the COVID-19 vaccine because of the way the medical industry has treated Black people since the start of this country.
My wife has described me as vaccine hesitant. I can't really argue with that, although I tend to think of it as more of an acute lack of enthusiasm.
I will absolutely not get the COVID vaccine.
One factor often cited for that mistrust, the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, one of the most infamous medical studies in U.S. history. Our colleagues at Code Switch examined the long shadow of Tuskegee and also pushed back on this idea that this is the main cause of this reluctance by many Black people to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Gene Demby is one of the co-hosts of Code Switch. Gene, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
So let's start by reminding people what exactly the study was.
Yeah, so the Tuskegee Syphilis Study, the full name was the Tuskegee Study of Untreated Syphilis in the African-American Male. It began in 1932, and it was carried out by the federal agency that would be a precursor to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that we have today. And one rationale for the study was that they wanted to see how the disease progressed over time in Black people differently. We spoke to Reverend Roosevelt Balms, who was raised by his grandfather near Tuskegee. His grandfather was actually one of the men who was unknowingly part of this experiment. And he would have these occasional checkups with doctors working with the government.
He was thinking that he was getting health care. In other words, they told him that if anything happened, he told them that they had bad blood.
So these doctors would give the men that they were poking and prodding, you know, placebos and occasionally some, you know, mild medications like aspirin, but they avoided any treatment that would slow the disease. And remember, you know, this is the rural South in the Jim Crow period. So this is often the only medical care that these men were getting.
I mean, there's a lot of enraging details about this study, but
yes,
one of
absolutely.
Them, I mean, syphilis had been around a long time. Its symptoms
were very long time.
Yeah, not much was there to be learned about this. And we knew at that point that it was serious. If untreated, it can cause blindness, deafness, dementia, and eventually even death.
Yeah, I mean, about a decade into the study, penicillin had pretty much emerged as the most common therapy for this disease. So there was treatment out there for them. So many of these men, they would go on to pass it on to their wives or their partners. And because syphilis can be congenital, they would pass it on to their children, too. So when the study was finally exposed in 1972, it became a national scandal. Reverend Baum told us that when it all blew up, that was when he found out about the study for the first time. And his family only found out that his grandfather was one of the people involved as a subject a little bit later when the government gave his grandfather a settlement.
I couldn't imagine learning about that as an adult for one of my family members.
Yeah, it's a horrible, horrible story all the way around.
So you're talking to Reverend Balms in the context of mistrust over the COVID vaccine. I was listening to this episode, and I'm waiting for him to say, and there's no way I'm taking this vaccine.
Right. But that's, you know, not what he told us at all. He said he was absolutely getting the shot.
I'd rather have the shot than wait and see whether I'm going to fall dead.
Yeah, and then you kept exploring this and did some reporting that maybe Tuskegee is an overblown reason for this hesitancy among Black people.
Yeah, this was a little surprising to us, but I guess it makes sense. We spoke to Harriet Washington. She studies the history of medical ethics, and she wrote the book Medical Apartheid. So one of the first things we asked her was, should we talk more about this long shadow of Tuskegee as, you know, as a driver for some of this elevated hesitancy among Black people?
No, because it's the wrong question.
You know, the history of medical experimentation on Black people stretches back farther and much wider than Tuskegee. There were all kinds of horrible experiments, you know, where enslaved people were used as subjects. But more importantly, she said that the opinion research out there shows us pretty clearly that Tuskegee is not the driver. She pointed to one study that found
people who have never heard of Tuskegee are more likely than others to distrust medical research.
Which, you know, kind of makes sense when you think about it.
You know, people may not have known the encyclopedic history noted in my book, but they do know that their own families and the families of their friends and many people they know have over generations been abused in the medical research arena.
I mean, a year into this pandemic, we have been having this conversation so many times of just how many different ways there are inequalities in how Black people get treated for medical conditions in this country.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that Harriet Washington sort of underlined. It's like we need to look at these inequities and how they affect the way Black people feel about the medical establishment. You know, just as one example, our colleagues Renee Montaigne and the Science Desk, they looked into the ways that Black women, you know, up and down the income scale, are much more likely to die during or after childbirth than are white women. You know, there are still all these huge differences in medical treatment that we get depending on our race. And, you know, when you zoom out, we have all these social realities that play a big role in the kind of medical treatment we get because of things like housing segregation and discrimination. Black people are more likely to live, you know, in old housing stock with lead paint, more likely to live near landfills or factories, you know, less likely to live in neighborhoods with trees and clean air. Here's Harriet Washington again.
Look at the data. They tell us that African-Americans who make $50,000 or $60,000 a year, who are, you know, solidly middle class by most standards, they are far more likely to be exposed than are whites who earn only $10,000 a year, which is profoundly poor. Profoundly poor whites are less likely to be exposed to environmental toxins than are African-Americans who are middle class. So you can't rely on socioeconomic data to find disease risk.
I mean, as you tick through all of these damning stats, it's pretty clear there are a whole lot of reasons why a person of color might be hesitant to go to the doctor, to get engaged in the healthcare system, to go sign up for a vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, on top of just having less access to healthcare to begin with, you know, black people are showing up to the doctor sicker. And when they do show up to the doctor, they're getting worse treatment. Harriet Washington says, you know, we're talking about black people's distrust as the problem, and not the lack of trustworthiness of the healthcare system.
It's not only lazier, but it's a lot easier to simply evoke Tuskegee. But it's simply not true. And it's not scientifically rigorous.
Harry says, frankly, we know better at this point, and we should do better.
That's NPR's Gene Demby on the long-lasting effects of the Tuskegee syphilis study and broader ongoing inequities in healthcare. Gene, thank you.
Thank you so much, Scott.
And if you want to hear that full report, you can find the Code Switch podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow, we have Times Prep sports reporter James Boyd and Post-Tribune freelance reporter Carrie Napoleon to talk about the stories they put out in print and online. We hope you can join us for tomorrow's program.